Taboo today during our end-of-year match. Starting November 1st and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KABU. Thank you.
Time could be running out for Tibet. I'm John Shack, host of Progressive Spirit, and this week I speak with the Dalai Lama's U.S. representative, Penpa Tsering.
So another 30, 40, 50 years down the line, if we are not able to go back with a settlement that is mutually beneficial for the Chinese and the Tibetans, you might find Tibet towns in Tibet, just like you find Chinatowns in your country.
Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. and coming up is One Land, Many Voices, exploring political, social, and cultural issues affecting the Palestine-Israel conflict. And at 10, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, Pacific Underground brings you arts, issues, and voices of Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. And thank you, KBOO members, for all of your generous support. And all new donations and the difference between last year's or previous year's and in the current year's increase for current and renewing members will be matched by the Collins Foundation's the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems, as we heard just a moment ago. You can do that right now. You won't even miss any of the upcoming programs, which you will not want to miss, when you go to kboo.fm and click on the word donate. Speaking of the upcoming programs, here's One Land, Many Voices on your community radio.
Prepare for the annual Christmas holiday. Christians who live in Bethlehem say that their plight has been neglected and forgotten. Christian Palestinians have lived in Bethlehem since the time of Christ, but have faced dislocation and repression since Israel was created in 1948. This hour, we examine the situation of Bethlehem today. Broadcast with a report on Al-Walija Village, which is a Christian Palestinian village located just outside of Bethlehem. This report was produced by Hassan Banora and Hazem Jamjoum.
In November 1947, the land of Palestine was inhabited by 1.3 million Arab Palestinians and just over 600,000 European Jews, most of whom had come to Palestine as part of the Zionist movement's effort to create a Jewish state on this land. The British Empire, who had been in control of Palestine since the end of the First World War, had promised in the 1917 Balfour Declaration to work towards the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. The Zionist troops that would become the Israeli army on May 15, 1948, began the implementation of military plans that called for the expulsion of Palestine's indigenous people and depopulation and destruction of their cities, towns, and villages. By the end of the war, over 750,000 Palestinians had been forced out of the land that became the State of Israel. Today, they and their descendants, numbering 7.5 million people, live as refugees and form the world's largest and longest-standing refugee cause. During the war, Zionist forces destroyed over 530 Palestinian population centers. One of these was the village of Al-Walija in the Jerusalem district. On October 21st, 1948, Nearly all the homes of Al-Walija were demolished by the Israeli army. Most of the residents were forced to flee to refugee camps in the West Bank and Jordan, where they number 12,500 today. More than two-thirds of the village lands were annexed to Israel and became inaccessible to the villagers themselves. Aisha Haj Musa Abu Ali, who was 15 years old at the time, describes her memories.
يا حبيبي يا ابني لما صارت أول النكبة هي اللي دهتنا كان بدك المضبوط.
Listen, my dear, if you want the truth of who is the one mainly responsible for the Nakba, it's the English. The English brought the Jews here and armed and trained them. At the same time, if they found anything with a Palestinian, even a grain of salt, they would imprison us. Then the English said they would leave, and they kept their promise and left. The resistance then put up barricades around the town to protect us from any attacks from the Jews. We expected them to attack from El Jora. The men of the village piled up sandbags, and barely a day passed before they attacked. The horror that we felt when we heard the news was unbelievable. What were we supposed to do? They attacked from where we did not expect them to, but still the people of the village managed to repel the attack. After that, we spent 6 months in the village. The barricades stayed up, and every day there would be an exchange of fire. Every day someone would kill or be killed. Then one day they launched a big invasion, and the firing didn't stop. It was Tuesday morning when they attacked, and the resistance held them off until Wednesday evening. They took control of the village and began destroying the houses one by one. That was the day of the Nakba, the day we left our village.
استلموا البلد وبدأوا فيها نسف البلد هذا اللي يوم نكبتنا وطلعنا من هالبلاد
Between the wars of 1948 and 1967, many of the villagers had set up temporary housing, living in caves or makeshift structures until, realizing that it might take a long time before they would be allowed to return, they rebuilt homes on the village lands that had remained in the West Bank under Jordanian rule. Aisha Mahmoud Abdullah Hadi from Walija was 17 when the Nakba took place. She still remembers the Walija village.
In Al-Walija, we were all farmers. We would plant and harvest. We had land, and it was a beautiful life. No one would steal or do anything to hurt the other people in the village. All the land was planted with grapes and peaches, and we had apples as well. We would play as children on the lands of the village and never felt afraid or anything like that. Today, none of us dares to go from here to here from the soldiers. They've really made every part of our lives difficult. I pray to God every day for our safety.
In 1967, after Israel occupied the West Bank, including the new Walija, nearby Bethlehem and East Jerusalem, it became very difficult to obtain building permits in Walija. Homes built after 1967 without permits were now subject to Israeli demolition procedures. Meanwhile, Al-Walija's land was coveted. Its springs, fields, and olive trees had been eaten up by a biblical theme zoo, Jewish settlements of Gilo and Har Gilo, and the Teddy Kollek Stadium. In 2004, Israeli city officials announced a new plan to construct Givat Yel, a settlement planned to house more than 55,000 Jewish residents on the lands of Al-Walija and nearby Palestinian communities. In addition to the 49,000 dunams taken from the village in 1948, an additional 7,000 dunams have been confiscated for the settlements of Gilo and Har Gilo. 1,000 dunams has been confiscated for Israeli bypass roads, and approximately 4,000 dunams have been confiscated for the wall and settlement expansion. The The situation of the villagers deteriorated significantly in 2002 when the Israeli authorities announced plans to build the annexation wall on the lands of Al-Walaja. Shireen, a member of Al-Walaja's village council, explains.
The village would be sealed completely, and we are a very small village. We don't have any facility in the village. We don't have a clinic. We don't have any kind of source of income here except of some pieces of land that will be cut off by the wall. So when you seal people and you have a gate and you can close it and open it, then you control everybody. I don't know how is it to grow up in a cage. I mean, it's going to be a real cage. It's going to be a real jail with concrete walls from one side and maybe a fence from the other and one gate closed and opened by an order of a soldier. So we're trying just to push it away from our front doors.
The houses on the remaining 3,000 or so dunams of Al-Walaja are under constant threat of demolition. The small Palestinian community is now completely encircled by Jewish settlements and the wall, enabling the Israeli army to imprison its residents simply by closing down the one remaining access road. Mahmoud Al-Araj, a 25-year-old activist with the Ansar Youth Center at Al-Walaja, explains.
There are, of course, several things facing the people of Al-Walaja that can be considered hot issues. Among these is the colonial expansion of the settlements, land confiscation. What's left of the village lands is a tiny fraction of what was once ours, most of which was taken in the occupation of 1948 and the subsequent occupation of 1967. What's left is less than one-third of the village lands. In addition to these, there is the issue of the apartheid wall, which together with the settlements has left us completely surrounded. There is also the issue of house demolition. Since 1975, approximately 50 houses have been demolished by the Israeli army. Currently, an entire neighborhood of the village faces complete demolition. That is another 50 houses. Another central issue is the very high unemployment rate, which has reached around 70%. Considering that the village has a population mostly made up of youth, this is an extremely high unemployment rate. The Israelis try to harass us in every aspect of our daily lives using all means at their disposal, whether through confiscation, placing checkpoints on any road in or out of the village, and even these roads, when we pave them, the next day the Israeli bulldozers come in and destroy it. Today, there is one way in or out of what's left of the village, and this road is threatened with closure by the apartheid wall once it is completed. So we do not know what the future holds in store for us in the village. The Israelis try to treat each time period with the means appropriate for that period. So in the period of 1948, maybe there was not very much media coverage of their crimes, so they used violence without anything to hold them back. So, for example, we have the policy of massacres, where one massacre was enough to scare the people in the surrounding area to make it easier for the Israelis to kick them out. Today, they use many tactics for expelling us that suit the current period, such as daily harassment, creating very difficult economic conditions that they can then exploit to push people out. There are various methods that they use. Either way, there is a clear continuity in the strategy of expelling the Palestinians that has continued over the past 60 years. Nothing has really changed except the methods themselves, using the ways of expelling us that are most suitable for the time period.
Al-Walaja is one example among hundreds and is a testament to the fact that while the event referred to as the Nakba of 1948 took place 60 years ago, the Nakba is a process of expelling indigenous Palestinians and the confiscation of their land is ongoing and is alive today as it has been throughout the past 60 years.
This report was written by Hazem Jamjoum for Badil and produced by Hassan Bannoura of IMEMC.org.
And from Bethlehem, Palestine, I'm Mary Smith.
You're listening to a special broadcast on Palestinian Christians in Bethlehem and other nearby towns in the West Bank. An upcoming event entitled Bethlehem Today will be held next Wednesday, December 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the Central Library. That's 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. Featured speakers include Allison Weir of If Americans Knew and Syed Banora, a Christian Palestinian who grew up in Bethlehem. We go now to Talk Nation Radio for an interview with a professor at Bethlehem University.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith.
Don't need to talk. All we need to do is force Israel to respect international law and human rights.
It was all civilian houses that were destroyed by the borderline. All we can say is that the attacks keep happening.
We hear from Professor Mazen Kumsaya, author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. His soon-to-be-released book is Hope and Empowerment, Civil Resistance in Palestine. Joining us next from Bethlehem is Professor Mazen B. Kumsaya. He teaches at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities, and he was born in Bethlehem. However, Professor Kumsaya received his higher education in Jordan and the U.S. He has U.S. citizenship. He was on the faculty of the University of Tennessee, Duke, and Yale University. Professor, just comment on what you know about Barack Obama, the president's remarks at the UN, and what they mean for Palestinians.
Well, I myself have not voted for Obama. I do have U.S. citizenship, and I encourage people not to vote for him because I didn't believe he was going to affect change. But a lot of Palestinians here in the West Bank, especially, have indicated that they were hopeful and they would support him and things like that. And I always thought that they are going to be disappointed at some point. And I think they have reached that point last week when Obama backed down on his demand for a freeze on the settlement activities. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And so I think many Palestinians have reached the conclusion that Obama is not going to affect any change in U.S. policy and that U.S. policy remains solidly supportive of Israel and continues to fund Israeli aggression, basically.
The time has come to relaunch negotiations without preconditions that address the permanent status issues, security for Israelis and Palestinians.
U.S. President Barack Obama in September at the U.N. Professor Mazen Kumsaya, what if the Israelis interpret this absence of preconditions to mean go ahead, build settlements, and they start to initiate a major wave of settlements? They're already building them.
Well, at this point, you know, there are 500,000 settlers living in the West Bank, including, of course, occupied East Jerusalem, which is part of the West Bank. These 500,000 settlers are anticipated to grow in the next 20 years to about 800,000 settlers. This land cannot sustain the kind of settlement activity that has been going on, even if the Palestinians, by some miracle, accept to be perpetually occupied. And they have been occupied, at least in the West Bank, since 1967, and then the remainder of Palestine since 1948. So I really think there's a big problem that's brewing, and that if we look at the violence and the resistance and the way the resistance builds up, this is just a natural law of physics. When you put people in situations where there's a pressure cooker, where their lands are confiscated every day, where they see their livelihood taken away, their water, their agricultural land, their ability to feed their children, you put 1.5 million people in Gaza, for example, you surround them with a fence in a piece of desert land, and most of them are refugees or displaced people. They can see even across the border. They can see the empty lands that they were kicked out from to create the State of Israel. These empty agricultural lands that are in Ashkelon, what Israel calls, and Sderot and those other places that they can see. And you can see why resistance develops, and you can see why resistance might escalate in the future. And you can see that fences, walls, and nuclear weapons and all of these things do not provide any kind of meaningful security. What provides real security is justice and equality. And this is the catastrophic, there's really only two roads, either one that leads to catastrophe, as Martin Luther King said. We either all live together as equals, or we die together as fools in war. So basically, we either have, you know, continue to kill each other, or we recognize that there's a possibility for equality and demand that Israel implement international law and human rights, which have a better roadmap to peace than this one that they are trying to peddle.
What about President Barack Obama heading the UN Security Council? Does that raise your hopes at all?
I think the indicators are solidly behind the idea that the Obama administration does not provide the change in U.S. policy. And I think a good evidence of this you can find, for example, in the U.S. administration out-of-hand rejection of the U.N. Human Rights Commission report on the recent attacks on Gaza, where 1,400 Palestinians were killed, most of them men, women, and children, civilians, who had nothing to do with the fighting. And Israel has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza using U.S. weapons, which is in violation of U.S. law, in addition to being in violation of international law. And the fact that Obama and Hillary Clinton and his representative at the United Nations, all three of them, made statements to the effect that they consider the report biased, even though it was issued by a Zionist from South Africa, who's a previous judge. This is something that tells us that, again, the U.S. is not going to pay attention to international law and human rights. And basically, it's a slap in the face of the United Nations and a slap in the face of international law and human rights. So it's a bad sign, and I am very skeptical that any change will be forthcoming. Obama speaks a very good line, but on practical matters, he still votes and acts as George W. Bush or any of them.
Your new book is Hope and Empowerment, Civil Resistance in Palestine, due out shortly from Pluto Press. Can you describe what you're getting at with this book? It's a history. You're also talking about some of the nonviolent ways people have resisted in Palestine historically.
Yes, the primary purpose of the book is actually directed to Palestinians to show us and show me, basically. I mean, most authors write books primarily to convince themselves of something, to show me and show the rest of the Palestinians that our history is inspiring. There is a lot of successful civil resistance that does not involve violence. And the beauty of civil resistance, it keeps our humanity. It keeps our common humanity. It allows us to retain this most beautiful aspect of our humanity, so that even if the conflict ends tomorrow, and I hope it does, but if it doesn't, it lasts another few years. One day it will end. And even when it ends, we cannot survive as a society if our liberation was built with violence and with destruction of another. Our liberation must be built based on our common humanity. And I think you see the difference between, for example, what happened in Algeria and in South Africa, where in Algeria, 1 million Algerians died in violent resistance. But even when the society did triumph and they did remove the colonizers, the violence remained endemic in the society because it was endemic in the resistance. And so I think that there would be less violent repercussions and less violent societies on all fronts. And I think Israel is the same way. If we look at the incidence of domestic violence, for example, in Israel, it's very high. That is directly related to the issues of the endemic nature of violence in Israeli society now. And we don't want to get to that stage. We want to diminish violence and show people that there is better ways of resistance than trying to get revenge and things like that.
You know, I can remember in January when Barack Obama first took office, Mustafa Barghouti writing and others writing that unless Palestinians could form a democratic collective leadership, they stood to lose a great deal. What do you think about that today?
I think one, of course, needs more unified leadership at some level, and we all hope for it and push for it. But also, we have to be realistic that in a diverse society like Palestinian society, or for that matter, Israeli or American societies, there's diversity of opinions, diversity of political factions, and so on. in South Africa under apartheid, there was also significant differences between groups like the African National Congress, the Communist Party, the Pan-African Congress, and so on. And they had different visions of where and how to achieve their ultimate goal of independence and equality for black people in South Africa. So I'm not as pessimistic as Mustafa Barghouti in looking at this and saying that they have to unify or we're not going to get anywhere. I think South Africa was able to get somewhere without a unity of leadership of black South Africans. There were more dominant ones, like the ANC was more dominant than other factions. But it does not mean that you have to have a unified leadership to achieve particular goals, especially when these goals are fully and 100% supported by international law and by basic human decency, like the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, things like that.
Just explain what you've been writing about when it comes to pollution in Palestine.
Yes, and it affects both Palestinians and Israelis. This is the bizarre situation that we live here in, and essentially lived with it since Zionism was created. The idea of Zionism, of creating a Jewish state in this land and bringing in all the Jews from around the world and settling them here in a very small area at the expense of the native people, have created paradoxes that are affecting the livelihood of everybody here, including Israeli Jews and others. I mean, I'll just give you one simple example. Israel refuses to let Palestinians develop sewage treatment plants here in the West Bank, even though we have some funding, some donors like Japan and Europe willing to pay for these things. But Israel refuses to let us do that because they want to make life here so uncomfortable for us that we would leave. But of course, Palestinians are not leaving, and they are producing sewage. And this sewage is running down the valleys and goes into the water aquifers. The water aquifers are ones underneath our land, underneath the West Bank, that Israel uses 80% of these waters. The Israeli public uses 80% of these waters. So here's the situation where Israel is willing to even poison and destroy its own sources of water for the sake of a politically expedient thing, which is to destroy livelihood for the Palestinians. And this is just one of hundreds of examples like this. The destruction of the commerce, the destruction of the economy, the destruction of the agriculture, the removal of 1.5 million trees that impacts, obviously, the climate and the weather here, and the air that we all breathe, whether Israelis and Palestinians. These are things that the political echelons in Israel decide on based on the political ideology of Zionism, not based on logic or reason or even long-term interests of Israelis living here.
Professor Komsaya, if you could speak to Jewish and American leaders and to peace groups interested in human rights in both Palestine and Israel, what would your message be, especially now that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is also heading the UN Security Council?
Well, I think the short-term interests of Zionism need to be looked at with a very careful examination versus what is really in the interests of people, whether Israelis, Palestinians, Americans who are footing the bill for all of this. And I think they need to look at it in terms of long-term. And long-term, this is not sustainable. An apartheid system has not succeeded. The French tried it in Algeria. The South African white minority tried it. Other, you know, the U.S. segregation tried it in the South. Segregation does not work. Apartheid does not work. Only justice brings peace and prosperity to all people, all the parties involved. And this is, I think, the main message that they need to hear, and they need to look at it. And there's scientific evidence that they can examine. There are facts that they can examine, documents on demography and population growth, water resources, environmental issues. These are all available, and we should set aside these antiquated notions of chosenness and racism, basically, and look at each other as human beings and that we all deserve a life. And we are all created equal, and so we should actually do that, just implement equality.
Of course, Martin Luther King ultimately deciding that it was relevant for Americans interested in racial conditions for African Americans to also talk about conditions for the Indochinese people that we were fighting. What about conditions for civilians in the Middle East? How relevant that we understand conditions for them and the interrelationship between our two worlds?
The reason we have such a poor U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar keeps going down is precisely because the Zionist movement has pushed for the war in Iraq, thinking that it's in the benefit of Israel. It is in the benefit of a few elite Israeli Zionists, but not certainly in the benefit of Israeli public. And yet they pushed for it, and they got it, and it was a disaster for everybody concerned. It was a disaster, first of all, for the Iraqis. 1.3 million Iraqis died since the U.S. invasion. And second, for the U.S. taxpayers and U.S. servicemen and women who died in Iraq, continue to die in Iraq and Afghanistan. And third, it was a disaster for the rest of the world community, for the Israelis and the Palestinians, and for the Europeans and others who are also getting significant backlash and significant problems because of this illegal invasion of Iraq that violated the United Nations Charter and other things. So that's why these things are all connected, and why we certainly cannot speak for the freedom of the Palestinians without speaking for the freedom of the Iraqis, and without speaking about the relationship of things like why the Zionists are now pushing for a war in Iran. I mean, the big brouhaha about Iran that is being cooked up in the United Nations is just a charade. It's laughable, almost, the kinds of statements that they're making about Iran, how reminiscent of what we heard about Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, dangerous regime, has to be changed, etc. This is all just banging the drums of war. And the American public and the Western public are beginning to wake up to this reality.
Professor Mazen B. Kumsaya teaches at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities. He joined us from Bethlehem. You can find his books at kumsaya.org. Kumsiyeh.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut. We're syndicated with Pacifica. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.
You're listening to a special broadcast on the situation of Palestinians in Bethlehem. Now, Pacifica Radio's Verna Avery Brown explores whether the wise men would be able to enter the Bethlehem of today.
If the baby Jesus were born in a manger in Bethlehem today, would the three wise men be able to freely visit him? This is an opportunity for us to take a look at the Middle East in terms of the politics that are taking place there. We see in the news today where Muslim pilgrims threw pebbles at a stone wall outside Mecca, shaved their heads, and bought sacrificial animals today, the third day of the annual Hajj pilgrimage to the Mecca area. What is the political situation like there for Palestinians and others? And joining us to discuss this is Reverend Canon John Peterson. He's the canon for global justice and reconciliation at the National Cathedral in Washington. And also Paul Nursi, the Palestinian Christian and American citizen who's traveled to the occupied territories, the West Bank and Bethlehem this past summer. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Reverend Cannon, we understand that there is going to be a special event taking place between Palestine and Washington this weekend. Can you describe that event for us?
Yes. On Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, the National Cathedral here in Washington and the Bethlehem Church, which is called the Lutheran Christmas Church, we'll be doing a special service together through webcast of celebrating the birth of Jesus.
Now, what is the situation like? These are Christians across the world linking through telecommunications. But Paul Norris, you've been to the area recently. What is it like for Christians, Palestinian Christians, trying to honor this holiday this year?
Well, it's very difficult under the Israeli military occupation. People are now surrounded by this huge wall. A lot of the towns, including Bethlehem, are almost completely surrounded. people can't get from one town to another. You can't get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, which is only 6 miles. And a lot of people have family on both sides of the wall. People are separated from their churches, mosques, hospitals, places of work. I have relatives there who had to quit their work because their work was on a separate side of the wall from their home, and it was only, you know, 5-10 miles at the most. It's a very difficult situation for them, and the wall and the military occupation are being supported with our U.S. tax dollars.
So describe this wall to us, and are you saying that people inside the wall cannot freely leave out?
Yes, that's correct. I met and talked with people who could not leave the Bethlehem area, for example, for the past 5-6 years. They can't go to Jerusalem. They have very limited amount of area that they can travel in. If they do want to leave, you know, they risk the possibility of not being allowed to come back in. You know, so if and in some cases they can, but it's just very difficult to leave, and even more difficult to come back in. There are thousands, I think, possibly tens of thousands of cases of Palestinians who have been denied entry permits to come back into their own country, whether it's in Bethlehem or other cities in Palestine. And I actually even have relatives that are in that situation.
How many Palestinian Christians would you say there are still living there in the area?
I think, I don't know the numbers offhand. I know historically the Palestinian Christian community was about 20% of Palestine before the creation of the State of Israel. I think now it's lower, and it's continuing to get lower. The Israeli occupation has hurt everybody, but particularly minority communities, which Palestinian Christians are a minority, being, you know, less than 50%. And many Palestinians, including Christians, have been forced to leave, and I would say, you know, maybe of the 6 million Palestinians living in historical Palestine, now it's got to be probably less than 10%, which would be less than 600,000.
Reverend Canon Peterson, what is the motivation behind this exercise on Saturday, this linking of the Christians here in the United States with the Christians in Palestine?
Well, when we were initially approached to do this, we felt that just simply because of the very nature of the National Cathedral being a catalyst for reconciliation and for interfaith dialogue, that this would be an ideal thing for us to be able to do, to be able to stand in solidarity with our Christian brothers and sisters in Palestine as they celebrate and prepare to celebrate the birth of Jesus in that historic city. And we here at the National Cathedral, at the National Cathedral, the very first stone that was laid in the cornerstone was a stone from Shepherd's Field in Bethlehem. And so the very root and foundation of the cathedral, we have the presence of Bethlehem, which, of course, remembers and commemorates each year the birth of Jesus. And so when we were approached, we felt that this was something that we want to do, because one of the things the National Cathedral welcomes people do at all times is to seek a deeper spiritual life. And what a more appropriate way to do that than to come to the cathedral to be able to celebrate this great event of the incarnation of Jesus.
So the question we asked at the top of the hour, if the baby Jesus were born in a manger in Bethlehem today, would the three wise men be able to freely visit him? What's the answer?
Oh, no, of course. It's impossible because of the wall. It would be impossible for any wise man to get to Bethlehem today.
Okay. Reverend Canon John Peterson, the Canon for Global Justice and Reconciliation at the National Cathedral, and Paul Norsey, a Palestinian Christian American citizen who's traveled to the occupied territories. Thank you both for being our guests this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thanks to my engineer extraordinaire, Andy York, and to Gloria Minot, who lent a helpful hand this morning in assisting with the production.
You're listening to a special report on the situation of Bethlehem today. If you'd like to find out more, there will be a talk at the Central Library in Portland next Wednesday, December 16th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Featured speakers include Allison Weir of If Americans Knew and Syed Banora, a Christian Palestinian who grew up in Bethlehem. The address is 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. We go now to a special report from Making Contact called From Brooklyn to Bethlehem.
And listeners, please note the date on that announced event. That date has come and gone, and I don't believe December 16th was a Wednesday this year. This is a rebroadcast of a previous program. Unfortunately, many of the topics are still relevant, although the announced event has come and gone. We return now to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO, your community radio.
As Christians around the world prepare for the annual Christmas holiday, Christians who live in Bethlehem say that their plight has been neglected and forgotten. Christian Palestinians have lived in Bethlehem since the time of Christ, but have faced dislocation and repression since Israel was created in 1948. This hour, we examine the situation of Bethlehem today. Broadcast with a report on Al-Walaja Village, which is a Christian Palestinian village located just outside of Bethlehem. This report was produced by Hassan Banora and Hazem Jamjoum.
In November 1947, the land of Palestine was inhabited by 1.3 million Arab Palestinians and just over 600,000 European Jews, most of whom had come to Palestine as part of the Zionist movement's effort to create a Jewish state on this land. The British Empire, who had been in control of Palestine since the end of the First World War, had promised in the 1917 Balfour Declaration to work towards the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine.
If that sounds familiar, then you're sharp a listener. We're going to do our best to get back to the point at which we had left it. Stay tuned.
We have had our own experiences that seem to have connected us forever. Tuesday afternoon, a young man named Darnell was shot and killed. A couple days later, a group of 32 kids were harassed and arrested for simply trying to attend a funeral to show their respects to their friend. The police stated that the kids had on a t-shirt that was gang-related that simply said, "Rest in peace, Fresh." All 32 kids were charged with unlawful assembling without a permit, which was an illegal action by the police. I believe that our people in a messed up situation because on top of not being able to trust the police that harass us and lock us up, we can't even trust our own people that are killing each other instead of standing together against these police.
To the hustlers, killers, murderers, drug killers, even the scribbles.
Jesus walks with them.
To the victims of welfare, feel we living in hell here. Hell yeah.
Jesus walks with them.
My name is Chris Alexandria. I'm 18 years old from Brooklyn, New York, and a student at Bushwick Community High School. I'm glad I got to be in a program such as this because it gave me a better understanding of your struggles and what you go through. I'm definitely able to relate.
Away from my spins, but you probably take away from my ends. Then I hope it take away from my sins and bring the day that I'm dreaming about. Next time I'm in the club, everybody screaming out. God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. The only thing that I pray is that my feet don't fail me now.
That shout out to Palestine was created as part of the Palestine Israel Education Project in New York. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Professor Sonia Nimmer is an oral historian and ethnographer at the Bir Zeit University in Ramallah, Palestine. She has also been active in Palestinian politics for more than 40 years. Here are some excerpts from a speech she gave in Oakland, California in October 2007.
Okay, I'm not going to talk as a politician or as an academic. I'm simply going to talk as a mother tonight, if you accept what I'm going to say, about a point of view of a six-year-old boy. What does he think of life? What does he think of politics? And I would like to share that with you. But I need to tell you a small introduction. In the 90s, 1994, there was a big bang called Peace in the Middle East. And we bought it. I bought it. I used to live in London then. And I was happily living and working like a normal human being in the British Museum. And then, hey, there's peace in the Middle East. Home needing me. So I have to go home and build the new Palestinian state. And I believed it. I saw all this handshaking and kissing over the television screens, and I bought it. Packed my things, quit my job, took my husband and my son, and I went home. 1 year later, the Intifada broke, and then we started to have disillusioned. We thought that we really did have peace. And then when I went there, I discovered that there is no peace. We still have occupation, we still have roadblocks, we still have tanks, and life still goes on and on under occupation. The thing that was shocking to us, but more importantly, I think it left a scar, a deep scar in all our hearts, especially my son's, who was very young then. The year 2002, I was sitting at home playing with my son with the computer on a new game. Suddenly the electricity went off, and then a rocket came down. And the rocket came down, it was so closed that not only everything shook, I felt that the whole world is collapsing around me. I was alone at home with my son in total darkness, and I didn't know what to do. So I took him and I went downstairs, because I lived on second floor. And the rockets were coming, and the sound and the noise was so terrifying. And I, as a mother, I had to protect my son, but I couldn't think at that very moment where is the safest place to take him. So I went downstairs where the boiler's room, and then we were shaking with the rockets coming down. I was thinking, suppose the whole building collapses, so they're not going to find our bodies. So perhaps maybe I should go upstairs and die in my own flat. So I grabbed him again upstairs, and we went upstairs. And finally I decided maybe perhaps under the bed is the safest place. So I put him under the bed. I laid on top of him. He didn't say a word all the time. I was just whispering in his ear. Every time the rocket comes, it's coming, it's coming. I know it's going to be a big bang. Don't worry, it's going to go away. We're going to be safe. I love you. And he didn't even shake. Every time the rocket comes, I just feel his body stiffens. It was over, finally, after, I don't know, 1,000 years. A few hours later, he still wouldn't talk about it. He still doesn't want to speak about this experience. 5 hours later, I said, okay, it's time to go to bed, trying to be the brave mother. And we went to bed. A minute before that, he gave me a big hug, and he said, Mom, thank you for protecting me. That's when I collapsed. I wasn't tough anymore. But after that, he never spoke about this experience. And I know somehow, somewhere deep inside his heart, there is still an echo of rockets inside his heart. And it was difficult for me to understand what he feels. It was difficult for me to make him get out of this trauma because he didn't speak about it. But in the same time, I didn't want all this violence to become anger inside him, and the anger will turn into violence. And this is a whole cycle that never ends. So I tried my best all the years after that. Instead of making him feel that he wants to kill and he wants to get revenge and he wants to get rockets and he wants to play with toy guns, I tried my best to make him feel that he wants to grow up and he wants to change the world and make the world a better place. Every time I say goodbye to my son when he goes to school, I get scared. And every time when he comes back, I'm relieved. Because I don't know whether in these 6, 7, 8 hours he stays at school, whether we're going to have curfew and I won't be able to go and get him from school, or we get shooting, bombardment. This kind of worry that is every day that we live under this pressure. And this pressure which we talk about, we're not talking about occupation as only having tanks going around and bombarding all over the place. You know, the first thing that my son wanted when the curfew went out after 23 days, he wanted to have an ice cream. This is all what he has in mind. I want an ice cream. This is what we need. I just want to be able to take my son to school, and I know that he will come back normal, like alive. I want to go to university and not to see my own students being stripped in front of my own eyes by the soldiers. You know, there was one student that was stripped naked with only his underpants on the checkpoint. For a whole semester, he wouldn't even look me in the eye because he was so ashamed that his professor saw him naked. In our society, this is very important. This is the occupation I'm talking about. I am worried that if someday my mother dies or something bad happens to my mother who lives in Jenin, I won't be able to get to her in time. I won't be able just to get a taxi or take a car and just go to her, because at night I cannot travel, and I'm not sure there will be roadblocks or not during the day. And I always hope to God, please God, make her be safe until the daytime so I will be able to get her in time. This is the occupation I'm talking about. I'm talking about an occupation where you can't speak because you are seen as a terrorist. So what do we do? What are we doing for the whole globe? We have all this planet Earth. What are we doing to it? Palestine is a small country. I know the problem feels so big because we live it. I live it every minute of my day. But in the same time, Palestine is not the only place that's facing this problem. If not occupation, it's poverty. If not poverty, it is disease. If not disease, it's ethnic cleansing. And it's only by doing only a few on the top. And we all have to pay for it, and we all have to suffer because of that.
The fight for land causes agony all around the world. I have heard your story, Palestine, and now on Native Americans' behalf, I would like to make their resistance known. Here in the United States, there is a subtle but existing battle of the true owners of this land. The sad part is no one acknowledges the indigenous people who continue to endure their struggle to survive. Hopefully you get some sense of solidarity in the fact that there are others fighting this battle as well. Palestine, I understand that they have tried to erase your history and your culture and call it Israel. They gather your friends, family, and anyone who is like you and oppress them, mistreat them, jail them, kill them, and lock you down between these walls. Your refugee camps are our Native American reservations, full of the same injustices, broken down homes like yours, bad supply of food and water like yours, and complete colonialism forced upon you and all of us. Because after all, how could I forget New Orleans, Baghdad, Rwanda, Haiti, Darfur, and Vietnam? We must go on and speak out. I am Michelle Varela, 19 years old, living in Queens, New York. I was really self-conscious about recording this, so I hope you like it. The PEP organization has opened my eyes and allowed me to see into the lives of others, and now I give you the same privilege in return as a thank you.
That was Ashel Varela's response to digital stories that were created by young people in Palestinian refugee camps. Both the digital stories and radio pieces were produced as part of the Palestinian-Israel Education Project workshops. Before that, you heard Professor Sonia Namir from Palestine speaking with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement on building solidarity between Palestinians and Black and New African communities. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Palestine-Israel Education Project. And thank you to Dan Turner and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 0607, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer producer, Puck Lowe associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy and Samson Rainey interns, and I'm executive producer Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You've been listening to a special broadcast on the situation of Bethlehem today. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned.
They've canceled Christmas in Bethlehem. They've canceled peace in Bethlehem. In a land once known as holy, the gun is in control. They've canceled Christmas in Bethlehem. They've canceled freedom in Bethlehem. They've canceled hope in Bethlehem. They've locked the little town behind a ghetto wall. They've canceled Christmas in Bethlehem. And though angels are singing, they're trapped behind the wall. Yet angels keep singing down in Beit Sahur. And if our Christmas songs and prayers are not to be in vain, we must pull down that prison wall, the strangling Bethlehem. And the wall must fall. The wall must fall. If peace on earth is to come, the wall must fall. They've canceled wise men in Bethlehem. They've canceled shepherds in Bethlehem. They've stopped the wise men at the checkpoint, and the shepherds can't leave home. They're under curfew. Bethlehem.
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot fail.
KABU is gearing up to celebrate 50 years of community radio, and we need your help. Take the Big Events survey on KABU.fm and help us decide what kind of events you would attend or help build. Go to KABU.fm and click on the survey banner to help prepare for the Kaleidoscope of KABU, Past, Present, and Future, 50th Anniversary Celebration.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. Well, the Flashpoints team was in downtown San Francisco at the Federal Building, where there was going to be a protest to fight for the release of the 82-year-old mom, the very troubled mom, of noted activist Renee Saucedo, an immigrants' rights activist, I might add. But it turns out about an hour before the protest was to begin, the Department of Homeland Security announced that this 82-year-old mom, fragile, very fragile, would be released back to Renee Saucedo, who was very upset about it. So it actually became a birthday celebration for Renee. Here we were in the street there. We heard the voices of the people standing up. We spoke with Renee, and we want to share all that with you right now. Listen to this.
Well, this is Sister Estela over here from St. Paul of the Shipwreck. She's got a song that we can all learn together. El refrán como